Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, telling the stories of unsung heroes behind the success. On this episode, we chat to Mike Rowe, a man who has worked with the likes of Stevie Nicks, Eric Clapton, Nas, Sheryl Crow, Keith Richards, Mick Jagger, The Waterboys, Dave Stewart, and the future sound of London. Despite that impressive CV, Mike is perhaps most prominently known for his studio and live contributions with a band containing, without question, the most explosive sibling rivalry in British music in the last 20 years. I am, of course, talking about Appleton. Who can forget Nicole and Natalie's 2003 masterpiece, Everything's Eventual? Certainly not I. Still holding out for that reunion. Mike has also played with Oasis on a number of tours and albums, and is currently doing his thing as keyboardist for Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds. We're now sat in Le Zenith in Paris, where Mike's just finished a sound check for a sold-out show this evening. How's it going, Mike?
Yeah, fine, thank you very much. Drinking coffee in the sunshine in Paris. Life could be worse.
There we go. How was the sound check?
Sound check was fine. Sound checks are weird because you basically play in a big clattery old hall, and the sound bears no resemblance to what it's like when you've got 15,000 people in it. But it's just a way of... We do the same songs in sound check. We've got a little brass section coming out, so it's just basically for them, really. Yeah, we do about 5 or 6 songs and make sure the gear's working okay. No surprises, really.
Is there any changes? Because it's obviously a smaller venue. I saw you sound check at the O2 the other day. Mm. It's a bit of a smaller venue, this one. Is there any changes from your perspective, or is it just for the people out front?
It's always a bit nicer playing, for me, a bit smaller places. When you play big places, I know that as a punter, I wouldn't bother going to see a band in a big arena. You lose the detail, I think, as a musical thing. Yeah, it's much more enjoyable, smaller, 2,000, 3,000, 1,500 seat Shepherd's Bush type sizes. Yep. They're my favourite. And also they sound, I think, a lot nicer because it's sort of wood rather than metal and that kind of thing. So, yeah... It does have a bearing on how you feel up on stage, I suppose. But other people enjoy the large spectacles and see lots of people. They get off on that, and yeah, I don't so much. I'm quite happy to have a smaller, where I can see some faces in the audience. Is nice.
Great stuff. And I see that Noel's keeping you on your toes a bit because he's changing the set list most nights, I see, which is a rarity.
It is a rarity. Normally the set list is laminated. I think he stumbled upon a sort of a set list now. This is the sixth gig. Yeah, I think he stumbled across a formula that he's happy with. And it'll change a little bit. There's normally one or two songs that are interchangeable. And he and I do acoustic songs in the middle sometimes. So he might put a couple of those in. He likes doing more acoustic songs in America because the audience listens more and don't sing along. And he changes the melody a little bit from how the record is. But if you try and do that playing acoustically in a venue, you can't hear it because the audience is singing along the original melody. So it will change a little bit, but he doesn't like a lot of change.
Yeah.
He's a man that likes...
Even the sound check set list is the same all the way through.
Pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much. And obviously you guys are pretty well drilled playing together. This is the sixth gig. You played an extensive gig in 2011. But I know you personally have played with some of the guys for Sheryl Crow's band. Is that right? Is that Tim Smith you played with?
Tim Smith, who used to be in a band called Jellyfish, for those old enough of you to remember. Great band.
Is that how he became involved? Was it through you?
Jeremy and I know Noel, and we did the first High Flying Birds record. Noel had a guitarist who came down to start rehearsals. That didn't work out, so he asked us if we knew anyone, and Tim, although he's from America, and he's great. He's a great guitarist. He can do the job. Noel just wanted someone that could do the job, and we were going to America shortly after that, and it's worked out really well. He's sort of in, so I played with those two for about 15 years.
Great. That must be easy for him to lock into straight away.
Jeremy Stacey is truly, and I really hate to say this, but he's a great musician. He's so solid. You know exactly what he's going to be. He's the drummer. His kick drum is just... he's a real light player, normally like jazzer, and could do all kinds of stuff, and I do quite a lot of work with him, but with this it's just bang, 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 hitting it. But he's very consistent.
Fantastic.
You know he's gonna be there, sort of.
So
Tell us how playing with Sheryl Crow compares to the working practices of someone like Noel Gallagher when you go on tour.
Okay, well, Sheryl is quite American, and there's less hysteria about her than, say, someone like Noel. So it's a little bit, so it's smaller venues, perhaps, on the whole. Sheryl is more sort of about doing lots of different songs, and so there'll be 60 songs she'll throw in maybe one of them. So you've got to keep on your toes more. Noel is more regimented. It's going to be, there's no surprises. Sheryl, on a personal level, Noel's a great musician, but Sheryl's an amazing, naturally gifted musician, and she can hear things. She plays the piano as well, so it means I can't really fuck about.
Yeah.
And if I do, well, I can fuck about, but she can hear it better than most people. Noel, I can get away with murder because he doesn't really. He just lets me do what I want. Stage left, to be honest. Yeah, I can.
Appropriately, stage left. Name the podcast. So there we go.
The only
lovely
place to be.
Stage Left Podcast is the story of the guys behind the success. Can you tell us where your musical story starts? You know, the first time you picked up an instrument or went down that route.
Okay, I think I was pretty young. Evidently, I was about two or three, and I started playing the piano. Yeah, I was. My parents were farmers in the middle of nowhere in Buckinghamshire, and I've got two older brothers, both musicians, and they played a lot of Beatles stuff. I mean, I was born in 1970, so there was a lot of Beatles stuff flying around, and I remember just playing along on the piano to the Beatles from a very early age. And I remember thinking, God, why does anyone else? I was about 9 or 10. I remember thinking, oh, why are there any other bands? It was a ridiculous notion I had, but I think I was lucky that I started when I was very young. And I think, like anything, like languages or something, if you learn a language from if you're in a household where there's English and French speaking, your grasp of French, it's easy, basically. And I just, lucky enough, I got into it when I was young, and I can't understand how anyone else can't hear something and play it.
Fantastic. The question I have that rises from that is, when you first started playing, obviously two or three, you're not going to be able to hark back to that quite, but what do you think you were trying to accomplish when you were first playing? Did you have specific ambitions, or did
you? No ambitions at all. No, I just enjoyed it. And both my brothers played guitar. My parents weren't, they are musical, but they didn't play. We had no friends of the family that were in media in any way. I mean, my only peer, I suppose, is watching people on Top of the Pops and going, well, okay, well, how do I quite fancy that. Or not even fancy that, I just enjoy playing music with people from a very early age. So, you know, teenage years was in bands, you know, all the stuff you do.
And so how did that transpose into being? Yeah, well, tell us that.
Well, a series of probably lucky breaks, really. I think having two brothers that were doing music as well, although they weren't making a living at it at the time, I think probably what happened is I couldn't read music, and I applied. I was 18. I did A levels, usual stuff, because I thought, well, I'd find music easy. I'd play with all the people in the local town. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, this, I could do this, I reckon. I think, I'm not sure. But there were no music courses then, unlike now, where you could go to that you couldn't read music. I went for an interview at John Lennon School of Music. I sent them a demo tape. They liked it. And then I went there, and you had to be able to read music to get in, and I couldn't. Yeah. So they said no. So I did a qualification in business studies, because I thought, well, the chance I'm not going to make a living in music, so I'll do something straightforward enough to get a job. So I did that, and then I was just in loads of bands and having various shit jobs in this local town called Aylesbury, which is just out of London. Yeah. And then I suppose I thought, and I was in loads of bands, and people, record companies came down, and it was, oh, you're really good, and then nothing happened. And I was probably about 24, 25, and I saw an advert in a newspaper called Melody Maker, which isn't going anymore, but that's where you look to be in a band. And there was a band there looking for a keyboard player, and they were signed to Warner Brothers. I thought, you know what, I'll have a go. And I quite like the music. They were a band called Rachel Stamp, you may or may not have heard of them.
early 90s.
Yeah.
And I got the job, and that meant I could give up my day job of installing televisions, which it was at the time. Did that, and then I was just, I got lucky. The time, early 90s, there wasn't really many people playing the Hammond organ or putting keyboards out through pedals and amps and that kind of stuff, and I was just fucking around that. And then the next studio next door, there was these two guys, Brian and Gary from Future Sound of London. So I got that day, I started doing some work for them and got asked to do other stuff. And then I won, and then living in London, it was like, oh, this is great. Started earning some money, fuck. I remember getting the first session for a shampoo commercial, playing the organ. I got 300 quid and that allowed me to buy a new washing machine, which was just like, oh, I made it. And then I was doing a funk gig one night. Really, I suppose how I met Noel. I did a funk gig one night, London Hammond gig, and he was there. And he came back afterwards and said, "How are you doing?" sort of thing. I couldn't stand him because he's a northerner.
Yeah.
And then they rang. He rang me. They'd just done these big gigs in Nebworth, and I didn't think anything of it. You know, you meet people and that kind of stuff. And then he rang me and asked if they were doing an MTV Unplugged thing, and they asked me if I wanted to come along and play the Hammond, which I did. That went really well, and it went from there, really, to be honest, in a nutshell.
The MTV Unplugged gig is something I was going to get onto, because that was certainly the first time it came to your work came to my attention. Going back to obviously the day-to-day jobs, and was there any kind of family pressure as such for you not to go into the music industry? You know, you already had a day-to-day job installing TVs and making a living.
Yeah.
Did family say, come on,
no,
Mike?
No, my parents were pretty cool, actually.
Yeah.
They sort of let us do what we wanted. I think my eldest brother, Stuart, he probably had a worse deal on it, being the eldest, I think, and they wanted him to have a secure job and that kind of stuff. So he sort of went, worked in the bank. He's a musician, but he did the safe route, if you like. I think to be honest, they were fine. I remember when I rang them up and I just got a job with Oasis and I earned whatever it was to doing something, and they couldn't believe it. I mean, my parents are quite elderly, and they're not from that world. They couldn't really believe it, and they were really cool. I imagine there was probably an element of, you know, wait till he gets it out of his system, yeah. You know. And having kids now, I can understand from when they, you know, the point of view they're coming from. But they were really cool. They didn't encourage me, but they didn't disencourage me. And you know, I was independent. I had a job. I could pay the bills. I had a car. Mm-hmm. But I was always in bands. And I always took that really seriously. And I would always. Yeah, I really obviously wanted to do it. And
yeah.
You've got to want to do it to do it. Anything you want, same for anything.
And it's great that you don't have any family pressure. What about now? I mean, it's you know, you have a young family,
yeah,
I believe, is that right?
Kids,
so
yeah.
Now going on tour, it's like the flip side of that.
I stopped touring. I don't only tour with Noel, he says, in Paris, you know. But no, I stop. I don't tour with anyone else than Noel, really. And I spent a long time touring. I've been lucky enough to tour a lot with some great artists, but you have kids, things change, a cliche that it is, but things, I don't want to be away that much.
Yeah.
I like doing it a little bit, but I also much prefer the studio creating music than being involved in creating music rather than endlessly touring. But then I'm an old fucker, so there we are.
I think a lot of what you're doing at the moment would be deemed by young musicians starting in bands as you've made a success in the music industry. I think that's quite a fair assumption to make, rightly or wrongly. But I think, you know, what percentage now does this feel like a job to you? And how much do you love doing it? And how much of it is?
I still love it. Mm-hmm. I'm still sort of waiting. I'm not, but I've been. There's another element of someone knocking on the door and saying, actually, Mike, you can't be music. You're not trained. Go and get a proper job. Do you know what I mean?
We all have
which
that.
Is, which yeah, is very
yeah,
common.
Yeah. There's a lot of anxiety. Like, yeah.
But I suppose the longer you do it, the more confidence you have that everything's going to be all right.
certain things feel like a job sometimes, but I have been lucky enough to work with 99% of the people I've ever been this year with have been great. And you just wanna help make it as good as it can be. And if that's not playing or playing or whatever that is, it's just nice to be around those people, you know.
That anxiety of not, if it is anxiety, of not being able to sight read. When you've been in gigs where I know that, you know, Eric Clapton's come on stage, Keith Richards, or other musicians who, you know, have you ever been kind of put in a really awkward position where they say, right, give me this, or play this, and you don't know,
No,
all right.
No,
I've been thrown in the deep end.
Yeah, not really. The only time I was thrown in the deep end, I was playing with Oasis, and then I started also playing with Sheryl Crow, an American singer. It was pretty big at the time, and I and the two went on. I would work with Sheryl, then work with Oasis, and then it got to a point where I had to make a decision, and I'd been with Oasis 5 years, and I wanted to do something else, so I went with Sheryl sort of full time then. And so first date rehearsals for this big tour, 99 this no when was it yeah 99, and I turned up in Los Angeles, you know, at the rehearsal room, all American band, you know, all quite slick players and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, Sheryl handed me this sort of sheet music of the stuff. And it's like, oh, shit. You know, it's like tonight I walk in a pub and the music goes off the jukebox. You know, Sheryl, I can't read, you know. But I just done my own way of learning it, which is just learn it parrot fashion. Parrot again and again and again. But going to that, going from Oasis and stuff in the UK that I was doing to that level of detail with Sheryl really kicked me up the arse to just have to know it. Even if you don't like the part you're going to play, you've got to be able to show her you can play the part with exactly the right sound. So if it's a certain word, it's a, you get that certain word. So if it's with a pedal, you get that pedal. You nail that sound to the nth degree. And I was just so winging it. I am winging it still now, but I was so winging up till then. And that, I was with her for 11 years, and that just taught me that if someone wants you to play with them on stage, if you're going on tour supporting an album, whatever, you need to be able to know that album inside out first, and then you move away from it as a band. But first, you've got to turn up knowing it.
And your responsibility to find the exact sounds if you were matching something on a record, or?
I just listen and fuck about. I mean, now I use a lot of computers and samples and stuff, but yeah, I just know more now. Oh yeah, that's a B3 through or something, or that's a Wurlitzer, or now you can even sample the sound and create things, which I do now. Or you just ask. You just ring up the producer and go, I don't remember what, you know, excuse me, could you tell me what keyboard you use? Do you know what I mean? It's simple like that, but it's just good to go in knowing that you've done your work. If you don't get the job for whatever reason, it might be just your clothes are wrong, your face doesn't fit, all these kind of things, you're beholden to the lap of, you know, the gods, but just know it.
Fantastic, good advice. And for any young musicians, any pressures being a full-time touring musician that we don't see, that we don't hear about? We hear about the glamour, but, you know.
No, nice. Very lucky, there's not much. No, I suppose I don't get nervous about it. I think you get nervous about it first, but I think after a while you just get used to it. I don't want to say it's a job, but when you're getting paid to do something, it is a job.
Yep.
So it's quite clear, you have to know it. So I think probably people think that, you know, especially if you're on tour with quite leery characters or whatever, you're just out all night, up to no good. But if you're not in the band and a side man, if you like, or a side woman, you do have a responsibility of doing that gig. I know a lot of people who do what I do got carried away. And you become close to the people you work with. You're with them all the time, so you become friends of sorts, but they're paying you, so it can't be an even friendship. So if you fuck up again and again and again, they're going to find someone else. There's enough people want the gigs, so you've got to take it. It is a job. It doesn't feel like a job, but it is a job.
Just get the job done well.
Just get the job done well. You know. Nobody can ever hear it all. Nobody can ever hear it all. Nobody can ever hear. Nobody can ever.
Okay, so I'm interested in speaking to you, Mike, about your creative outlet in regards to being a multi-instrumentalist and having to play often with musicians who are quite dictatorial, perhaps, and giving you certain times in songs that you can play kind of more elaborately, if we like to go down that route. Have you ever had a problem with that?
No, I think, I don't know. I think you sort of, so someone rings you up and goes, you know what, can you come and help me? Can you come and play on this record? If you wanted, if I like the music and blah blah blah, yeah, love to, you know. So I turn up, and luckily now these are the people who sort of I do that with. They sort of know what they're going to expect. If they want some jazz cat to go flying around, that's not me. Do you know what I mean? So I luckily don't get those gigs. And if I do, I tell them straight, I'm not the man. So I suppose because what I do is quite a varied thing. A lot of it is just sound, sculpture, noises, or to the sort of traditional piano or Hammond or whatever. Normally what happens is the artist would have an idea of what they want. So say Noel, for example, he would sort of say, what do you actually do, some piano on this bit? Okay, all right. So, and I sort of know what he wants, the kind of Beatles-y piano, whatever. So you do that, and then you get the job done first, and then if I have an idea like, hey, why don't we try this, then you do that afterwards. But you go in and you do what they want. They're happy with it, okay, then let's just try this. It'll probably be shit. Yeah, especially with Noel, I always say, you'll hate it, but let's just try this. And some of it works, some of it doesn't, but it's normally better to go in and if they say to you, if the artist said to you, okay, I want some piano on that, and you go, I'm really not sure piano was going to work. And that's the first thing I mean. That's not the greatest start.
No.
Artists normally have an ego.
Yeah.
You're getting paid to do something. Okay, I'll provide that service. While we're at it, what about this? Do you know what I mean? And that's how most people, I think, do it.
How about Future Sound of London and Amorphous Androgynous?
That's quite different. That's sort of... But in a similarity, it's sort of... They just let me do anything, really. Yeah. They record everything. They have DAT tapes from years ago full of my shit that keeps coming out. So they often will either send me stuff and I do it at home, or I prefer to go down to their place and then just record a load of stuff. Loads of stuff. And I use systems now where I've got lots of different sounds on hand, lots of different guitar pedals, lots of amps, send it stuff. They either come to my studio and we do it, or I go to theirs and take a car full of stuff. Just blitz it, and then they'll choose afterwards.
And when you're working with them, do you feel like you are making the hippiest music that's ever been made?
Yeah. Some of it is. Some of it doesn't turn out as hippie-ish because of the constraints that now they're working with people, Weller and people like that. So it's going to have to be in a separate. And with Noel, there's sort of work with Noel. Sort of had to be in the thing. So yeah, but when I help them with their own huge stand-up or cosmic stuff or whatever or Amorphous, yeah, it's pretty mad. And you never really know what they're going to use. So you get a copy sent, you go, bloody hell, you use that rubbish. You know, it's up to them.
I listened to a track the other day that you played, is it called Divinity?
Oh, yeah, Little Miss Divinity.
Spectacular.
That's a long time ago.
It was spectacular. Yeah. Fantastic. And do you write songs? You've written songs in the past, haven't you?
Yeah,
for Appleton, is that right?
What's
you
that?
Wrote for Appleton, didn't you?
I did. You see, you must be the only person in the world that knows. Yeah, I do various bits and pieces. A lot of it I won't tell you because it's absolute shit.
But does that give you a creative outlet?
I do. I couldn't, especially being on tour, you can't just... I can't just end up playing the same old gig every night and doing that. I just go mad. So I always take a system with me where... Like this morning, Noel's done a new song that he and I did at Irish TV thing. We were just mucking about and it was recorded. So I got the recording and I just put some keyboards on it.
What's it called?
Can't tell you.
Oh, shit.
But it's really good.
It's on Irish TV, what, recently?
No, it won't be on there. It won't be on the TV because he'll make sure. But it was a radio thing. But
So there's stuff like that. Also, I do things for film and TV with friends at home in the studio in Brighton. So there's always stuff I've been doing. And sometimes people send me sessions to do on the road where samples are getting so good. And if you treat them right and you play it in the right way, they're really good. They're good.
Cool. I've got to know about when you recorded with Stevie Nicks, is that right?
Stevie Nicks did rep with Stevie Nicks a few years ago, yeah.
Tell us about that.
I was great. I knew her quite a bit because she was friends with Sheryl Crow and she was always around. Said hello, very nice.
What was her working practices like in the studio compared to
She was great. She was there all the time. She was really involved. We'd cut it, most of his stuff live. We'd muck about with it and then she'd go to a vocal booth and then we'd cut it live in Los Angeles. Yeah, she's great. She's Stevie Nicks. She's the real deal. Sometimes you meet these people and they're not. She really is Stevie Nicks. Yeah, she's cool because she doesn't try too hard.
Most musicians who walk into a studio, Stevie Nicks, walk out with their personal life in absolute tatters by the sounds of things with their history. But how do you deal with working with kind of big characters? I know you work with Nas as well, is that right?
Yeah.
How long ago was
that? Yeah, that was an album I did with him and Damian Marley. I was working on a thing. Oh, it sounds awfully glamorous. I was living in Los Angeles and I did an album, not a great album called Super Heavy. We did Dave Stewart together with Mick Jagger, Damian Marley, Joss Stone, A.R. Rahman. Anyway, it was meant to be the Flying Wilburys, but obviously
I didn't like it.
So I did that, and then I met Damian Marley, and then we got on quite well. And then he was doing that with Nas, and he just invited me down to do some playing on. Yeah, it was great. It was great. I mean, you're with these people, and you learn after a while just to be cool with it, really, and be yourself, and just do what you can, and and then go from there. There's a really good lesson I learned in a studio in Los Angeles. So there was all these heavyweights in the studios, Jagger, Stevie Nicks, lots of people in the control room. I was there, I was doing stuff on this bizarre project. And Don Was from Was Not Was came in the studio and he's a producer and a bass player. So you imagine there's a large control room in Los Angeles, Ponzi studio, blah, blah, blah. And everyone has an opinion in that room. Don Was comes in, everyone's like, all right. He goes to the back of the room, he stands there for 10 minutes, listens to that, doesn't say a word, and then leaves. Everyone in that room wanted to know what he thought. Rather than coming in the studio and going, hey, have you thought about doing that, like you do, like everyone does. Mm-hmm. There's 10 opinions in that room already, you don't need another one.
Yeah.
So the fact that he didn't say anything, that was, and I saw that in front of my very eyes. I knew I wanted to know what he wanted, and I knew everyone else wanted to know what he thought.
Mm.
So that was really, I try and emulate that. I'm too big a mouth to do that, but you sort of pick your moments. There's some fragile egos, big egos, and you walk into those studios or any studio, any artist, just be cool, do your job, try and do your own stuff, and then if you're feeling it, then you can flourish. But don't go in guns a-blazing.
Yeah, that's great advice. I mean, I think working with eccentric characters, you must have worked with some, a lot of the people you've worked with would have worked with some. I know Sheryl Crow started out as Michael Jackson's backing singer on the Bad Tour, which I went through in 1988. I was 5 years old. I was 5 years old, and I have an incredible story about that day, which I can't say on this podcast, but I'm going to tell you afterwards. Before we go on to the next bit, are there any classic stories you want to share at this stage, or you're going to save it for your book?
I remember the first day that I got an audition for Oasis. I wasn't really a fan. I'm a softy southerner,
Mm-hmm.
I got the call. I went in to the studio in London and met Noel again. Oh, I know how you're doing, blah, blah, blah. Okay. We did a song. It was called Round Our Way.
Great song.
Be playing. It was a nice song. And I played it and we ended with a band, the original band.
Mark Felton was on the
Mark Felton's harmonica.
Yeah,
great harmonica player. Yeah. Great. Lovely chap. And Noel came over and said, great, do you want to do it? Yeah, brilliant, okay. Excellent. And then we did an exile, I forget what it was, probably a big one. And at my peripheral vision, Liam comes through the door. And this is the height of the madness. This is 97. He hadn't slept for like 8 years or something done. And he comes in and all I knew about him was what I read in the newspapers. And he comes in. And when you play a Hammond, a B3 or C3, you often play it on this bench seat, which is a long seat. There's room for two people. And he comes to sit right. As I was playing, he came and sat right next to me, very close to me. And I thought he was going to punch me or something. This perspective called ginger haired, strawberry blonde, actually, officially. you know, who knows what happened, you know. At the end of the song, and I was like, oh, hello, Mr. Gallagher. And yeah, it was really cool. It's cool. That was the start.
So that was part of the Unplugged.
That was the Unplugged.
Series. Right, okay. Yeah. So as I say, this was the Unplugged gig, for those who aren't aware, was the first real gig that Noel did as a solo artist, in many ways.
Right.
I think it was a key gig in Noel's development towards being a front man and where he is now. Liam, the singer, was ill, in inverted commas, and what do you remember of the day? When did Liam pull out? Do you remember him heckling Noel at the side?
Yeah, because my brother, Noel had got me tickets for my brothers, and they were sitting next to him. Yeah, I remember all that as if it was yesterday. That was a big moment. I remember doing it. It was a great day. Because I thought, well, you know what? If it goes horribly wrong after this, I can show my grandkids that I was on TV once. I remember it was that. And then we finished the concert. And I hadn't fucked up too much, I don't think. And I went to, because I wasn't in their dressing room at the time. I just met them. So I knocked on the door and just said, boys, thank you very much. I loved it. You know, that was the pinnacle of my career. Amazing, you know. Thanks very much, you know, blah blah blah. And then Noel said, well, look, what are you doing in October? Of course I had absolutely nothing on. I'd probably be back to installing TVs. And then he said, well, we're recording Abbey Road if you want to come along. Abbey Road, fuck's sake. Fabulous.
No brainer,
that was it.
It was the gig that made me pick up a guitar in the first place, actually.
Was it really?
Yeah, it was. And what I did notice also is that, and we're going to play some clips on this, is that there's, when you play with Noel, and Noel is main front man and singer, he kind of then obviously relinquishes his guitar duties a little bit.
Yeah.
And there's more scope for you to
absolutely.
So we're going to play a bit of Some Might Say from that day, and you're absolutely tearing it up on that. It's amazing. Yeah, it's incredible. So let's have a little listen to that.
Yeah, you can actually apologise about that. I think I was really showing off.
Yeah.
Sure, I was. Yeah,
it's fantastic. It's noticeable actually when there's a lot of breaks now. Noel is looking, you know, if you look on Death of You and Me, that kind of thing, you're playing your kind of honky tonk thing and a few others rather. So, do you feel when you play with Noel as opposed to with Oasis, you get more of a chance to be a bit more expressive?
Yeah, I couldn't be heard in Oasis. Also, I was a lot younger. I wasn't probably as confident. I've got my sounds together later rather than earlier. I mean, you're constantly changing, and you listen to recordings you did even a couple of years ago, God, I'm overplaying there, or I'm doing too much, or I don't like that sound. You have an opinion on what you've done. There's very few recordings that you listen to and go, oh, I rather like what I did there. And yeah, I suppose he trusts me to do stuff. We come from a similar world musically, I suppose, similar ages. Yeah, he lets me. I like doing the acoustic songs at the gigs because I can change it
nice
willy-nilly, really.
Yeah, the acoustic ones are great. Wrapping up, just a couple of last points. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this, as you know, is a podcast to tell the narrative of a musician's life as well. Fast forward from 40 years now.
Okay, 40, God, I'll be 84. Okay,
there you go. Right. How will you look back on this specific period right now in your career?
Right now, at the career, very, very fondly. These are the good times. Healthy, got a great family, who allow me to go and do things like this. I like Noel personally. I find him very funny. I like his music. He trusts me. It's a good band. Yeah, there really are no complaints on it. I think looking back, yeah, whatever happens from now on, who knows what's going to happen to any of us. But yeah, I feel as if I've been very lucky. I've obviously done a lot of work, but I do feel that I've been extraordinarily lucky, to be honest, to do what I do and to sort of keep doing it and keep paying the bills, you know.
And do you have any musical ambitions left?
Oh God. I'd like to be in the studio with Johnny Greenwood for a couple of days. That'd be great, wouldn't it?
I'm sure you can sort that out, can't
you? I wish. I love being in the studio with other people trying to nail a take the old-fashioned way. I just like being creative. The only ambition that I have, I suppose, if I can keep doing that and being creative, whether it be on successful records or make successful records, I think if I can still keep doing it and make a living and enjoy what I do. I suppose that's the only thing I want to keep doing. Really, I was fortunate enough to do stuff with Dave Gilmour last year. That
wow.
was great.
Great.
Yeah. So
has that been released yet? Or?
I think it's coming out soon. Solo record. I don't know. I've great. Signed some forms for it. So, yeah. Just if I can just carry on. Make it, if I can find a way to carry on making a living out of being creative, that's amazing, isn't it, really?
I think that's where everyone wants to be.
I mean, if you can do that, you know how many people want to do that? Don't, unfortunately. But I think there are things that anyone you see who's doing that, they do have things in common that they've probably put it before everything else for a certain period of time. And they probably work really hard. Noel likes to give the impression he doesn't work hard, but he does. He writes songs all the time. Sheryl Crow, Jagger, all of them, they all have that thing in common. They all want it more, or they all wanted it more than anything at some point, and they've put the hours in. Like if you want to be a, if you're a plumber and you want to, your plumbing business is doing really well, it's exactly the same. You just have to do it.
Great advice. I think when I spoke to a friend of mine the other day, and I said I was interviewing you, and he said stage left is possibly the best job in the world you've got, because you get to experience all the stuff that most musicians want to experience, but you don't have to deal with paparazzi and all that kind of stuff. So you've got the best job in the world. So
I think I have, actually.
Yeah, I think you have.
Yeah.
Where's next on the road after tonight?
We're in Paris now. We've got a TV show tomorrow in Paris, and then we fly to Milan tomorrow night, gig in Milan. And after that, I have no idea. Somewhere in Europe, and I'll get on. I'll just follow everyone else.
Good stuff. Right, thanks very much,
cheers,
Mike.
Man.
Play well.
Pleasure.
And thank you
very much.
Time. Cheers.
Yeah, cheers.
Just say